Morning. Please open your Bibles to Daniel chapter 8. This is lesson 25 of our study of Daniel. We do have a handout for today's class. I mentioned last week that we'd be using the lesson 24 handout again today, but I just put the material we needed from that handout onto this one. So we just need today's handout, lesson 25 handout, and added a little bit more that we'll talk about today. Let me remind everyone that these handouts, as well as audio copies of these classes, are all available on the internet at studydaniel.com. Studydaniel.com. And usually I post the lessons in the afternoon, Sunday afternoon after they're taught. Let's begin our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we're thankful for this beautiful day you've given us. We're thankful for this opportunity you've given us to come and study your word and to learn more about you. We're thankful for this book of Daniel, and we're thankful for all of your word and all that you tell us there about you, about us, about your son, about your eternal kingdom. Father, and we're thankful that you've given us your word, and we pray that we will study it diligently and prayerfully and humbly, Father, and live it and love it and proclaim it. Father, we're mindful of the many who are traveling today, and we pray you will be with them and bless them in their journey, and that they will have a safe return back to their home, and that those who are traveling from here will be back among us soon and back with us safely. Father, we pray all of these things in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. Last week, at the end of class, we read verses 5 through 7 of Daniel chapter 8. And we saw there where a ram with two horns, denoting Medo-Persia, was trampled by a goat from the west, denoting the Greeks. Now, there's something about that vision that tells us without any doubt that this vision was not written in the 2nd century BC, as many of the liberal critics would have us believe. But we have to look a little deeper into this vision to see what that is. What is it? Well, note that Medo-Persia is denoted by a ram, and the Greeks are denoted as a goat. After Alexander the Great, who we're going to talk about more today, later, visited Egypt, he went down and visited Egypt, and after that trip, he was forever thereafter depicted on coins as a head adorned with the ram's horns of the Egyptian god Amun-Ra. From that point on, Alexander was very, very closely associated with ram's horns. In fact, 1,000 years later, Muhammad would call him Alexander the Lord of the Two Horns, the ram's horns. And in fact, if you look at the handout today, down at the bottom, you will see a coin, an ancient coin, showing Alexander the Great on the face of the coin. And what do you see right there above his ear but a ram's horn? And in fact, that's how he was always depicted after that trip to Egypt. You can tell by looking at a coin whether the coin was minted before or after that trip to Egypt, because after that trip, he always had the ram's horns. They were very closely associated with Alexander the Great. One commentator said it's impossible to believe that the writer of Daniel could, in the face of universal attribution of the two ram's horns to Alexander, represent Persia, the power he overthrew, as a two-horned ram. It would never have happened if this had come from the mind of man in the 2nd century B.C., as the liberals want us to believe. Now, we know why the Medo-Persia is a ram and why Greece is a goat, because that's what the vision showed. That's what God showed to Daniel back in the 6th century B.C. when he received this vision. But if the liberals were correct, that Daniel just came from the mind of man in the 2nd century B.C., this would disprove that. If they argued that, this would disprove it. No one at that time would ever have looked at Alexander and said the party he overthrew was a ram. They would have said Alexander was the ram. Everybody said that. It would be the same as if someone today wrote a book about the Eisenhower administration and the Kennedy administration, and they decided in that book to describe the Eisenhower administration as the days of Camelot. It would be the same as if someone today wrote a book about the Reagan administration and the Carter administration, and they decided that maybe they should refer to Carter as the Gipper. I mean, it'd be ridiculous, right? It's the same argument here. It's the same argument here. It's the same. We know this book was not written, as the liberals tell us, in the 2nd century B.C., from the mind of man. In fact, it's not from the mind of man at all. This came from God, and it came when Daniel says it came, much earlier than the 2nd century B.C. All right, as I mentioned last week, we read verses 5 through 7 of Daniel chapter 8, so I won't read those again, but let's talk about those verses. Who is this goat from the west? Well, I've already mentioned, we know who that is. History tells us who it is. History tells us the great power that overthrew the Medo-Persians, it's Greece. And in fact, we're not left with any doubt here, because if you skip down to verse 21, it in fact says that this goat denotes Greece. So we know, without any doubt, that this goat denotes Greece, and that the ram denotes Medo-Persians. Well, this goat has one conspicuous horn. One conspicuous horn, and it charges the ram with the two horns, and it comes from the west. Again, that is in perfect agreement with what history tells us. Alexander the Great and the Greeks came against Persia in 334 BC, and they came from Macedonia and Greece, which is means they were coming from the west. And like this group, like this goat, Alexander moved very, very fast. In fact, the hooves of this goat here don't even touch the ground. That's how fast it's moving. And that's how fast Alexander moved. Alexander died when he was in his early 30s, but by that time he had conquered the known world. He moved very, very fast. Well, so who is this conspicuous horn on the goat? Well, we already know. That's Alexander the Great. It can be none other. Verse 21 tells us this horn was the first king. Well, Alexander really was the first king of the consolidated Greek Empire, because it was Alexander really who consolidated it. So it's perfectly correct to call him the first king. And in fact, this attack by the goat appears to be unprovoked in this vision. And in fact, history tells us that's what happened. The Greeks attacked kind of unprovoked at this point. I mean, they'd had some battles earlier we're going to talk about, but this particular one was unprovoked. And 3 years later, Alexander emerged victorious. One commentator said, Alexander's conquest of the entire Near and Middle East within 3 years stands unique in military history and is appropriately portrayed by the lightning speed of this one-horned goat. Despite the immense numerical superiority of the Persian forces and their possession of military equipment like war elephants, the tactical genius of young Alexander proved decisive. Well, that commentator has some good points, but I think he's given Alexander a little too much credit. Yes, Alexander was a tactical genius, but Daniel's telling us Alexander had little help. In fact, Daniel's telling us Alexander had a lot of help, because this had already been written down before Alexander was even born. We already knew what was going to happen here. I mean, we knew who was going to win this battle. And of course, God was behind this. And we've talked about the importance in God's plan of the Greeks and their combination of all the language and the culture with the Roman peace. So that was all part of God's plan. Let's talk a little bit about Alexander the Great. Fascinating historical figure. For a long time in world history, particularly when this was being written, Greece was just kind of a sideshow. It was not really a big world power. It was a small, divided country. And really all it was known for was, of course, it had Greek culture, but it was really just fighting among itself. They would just fight among the little Greek city-states, fighting among themselves. And they were kind of an insignificant player on the world stage when this was being written. Yeah, you had the Babylonians and the Chaldeans, and then you had the Medo-Persians. They were the major players. Greece was not a major player. They were around, of course, but they were not a major player. How did Greece come to take center stage here? How did they come to supplant these major world-crushing powers that we see here in the book of Daniel? And how could Daniel have known about it hundreds of years before it happened? Well, of course, we know the answer to those questions. God was telling Daniel about these things. The secular historians have a little more trouble answering those questions, because they don't answer it in terms of God. So what they try to do is redate the book. Well, the Greeks were really never able to put up a united force. They were always divided, and they were always fighting among themselves. They had all of these famous Greek city-states. You had Sparta and Athens and Thebes and Macedonia. Those were the Greek city-states. And for about 500 years, Greek history was just characterized by conflicts among these Greek city-states. Now, they had also been battling Persia, though, off and on. So some of the city-states would battle Persia. They didn't unify against Persia. In fact, sometimes they used Persia against the other city-states, but they had been battling Persia off and on. In fact, You can go all the way back to Cyrus the Great, who we've already met in the book of Daniel, and find out a conflict between Persia and Greece. Because Cyrus the Great conquered the Greek-inhabited Ionia, and that was way back in 547 B.C. So they were already having some battles back and forth, just nothing major. Now Xerxes, we know who Xerxes is. He is the king from the book of Esther, Persian king from the book of Esther. And Herodotus describes his Greek expedition in 480-479. Herodotus describes it in 480-479, which was includes the Battle of Thermopylae. Now, you may or may not have heard of the Battle of Thermopylae, but you may have heard of a movie that came out a few years ago called 300, which is a pretty good movie, actually. It was a kind of historical look back at the Greeks and the Persians. And that movie is about the Battle of Thermopylae. That's where you had a very narrow pass, and there was a huge suicidal stand against the Persians by the Spartans. There were 300 Spartans and 100,000 Persians, and they held that pass for about 3 days to delay the Persians. Of course, they died. I mean, it was 300 against 100,000. Eventually, they were going to lose, but they held it for a very long time. The king, the Persian king that was against them was Xerxes from the book of Esther. In fact, that battle happened probably between Esther chapter 1 and Esther chapter 2. And that was a conflict between the Persians and the Greeks that was leading up to the big conflict of Alexander that we're getting close to here. About 10 years after that Battle of Thermopylae, the Persian army again came up against the Greeks. And by the way, that Battle of Thermopylae, they won that battle, but they really lost that conflict because they had a big naval loss, and they came home defeated, the Persians did. So they come back against the Greeks later, and again they lose about 10 years later. And at that point, their struggle with the Greeks really came to an end. They still had Egypt and Cyprus, but they didn't really have much to do with the Greeks after that. Xerxes was killed. He was succeeded by Artaxerxes, and Artaxerxes is the king that let Ezra and Nehemiah return. Now, the Peloponnesian Wars, you may have heard about them, those are internal conflicts among the Greeks, particularly between Athens and Sparta. And in the last of those wars between Athens and Sparta, Sparta made an agreement with Persia. And they said, Persia, if you will help us with Athens, then we will give you certain considerations and things. And in fact, Sparta was able to defeat Athens with the help of Persia. The problem was that meant Persia was back in Greece, which turned out to be a bad thing because Persia again turned their sights on Greece. But in 370 BC, a Greek king arose named Philip II of Macedon, and he is on your handout. He's right here in the center. I've got a bust and a coin of Philip II. And in 7 years, he was able to do something that had not happened in 5 centuries. He was able to unite the Greek city-states. Now, one of the reasons he was able to do that was because I think they all recognized Persia was again a threat. So he united the Greek city-states, and then he died. And his son came to power, and his son was Alexander the Great, who, of course, is also here on the handout. So Philip, in fact, was assassinated, and he was succeeded by his son, probably a teenager, Alexander the Great. Now, you know, a lot of times people like to say, oh, I was educated under so-and-so, and I studied under so-and-so, and that sort of thing. Don't ever get into that fight with Alexander the Great, because Alexander the Great studied under Aristotle. You're never going to win that fight with him. He studied under Aristotle. Aristotle was his tutor. That's who raised Alexander the Great, Aristotle. And then he came to power, and he was just a teenager, and he was dead by the time he was 30, early 30s. In that short time, Alexander the Great conquered the known world. Now, on one of his campaigns, particularly interesting, he brought him to Jerusalem. And he arrived there probably around 329 B.C., and he was dead around 323 B.C. So everything in Alexander's life is very compressed because he wasn't around very long. Now, the Jews, when Alexander arrives, are terrified. Why? Well, I mean, certainly having the Greek Empire show up is bad enough. But the Jews had supported the Persians in an earlier conflict they had with the Greeks. And that involved the city of Tyre. And the Jews had said, "We cannot help you, Alexander the Great. We cannot help you, Greece, because we have a treaty with Persia, and therefore we can't help you." So when Alexander the Great showed up at Jerusalem, the Jews were terrified. History tells us Alexander shows up to the gates, the high priest comes out, the Sanhedrin, they all come out. Alexander gets off his gigantic white horse, very famous horse, by the way. They say that when Alexander was on that horse, he was about 13 feet off the ground. Gets off that white horse, and he bows to the high priest, the Jewish high priest. You know, what is behind that? Very odd. The Talmud describes what happened. The high priest came out with the Sanhedrin, the priesthood. Alexander comes off his horse. He dismounts. He bows down to him. Does not destroy them. Does not subjugate them. And in fact, he tells them, as long as you're loyal to me and pay taxes, I'm going to leave you alone. Out of gratitude, the Jews did at least two things. They said, for the next year, every male child born here is going to be named Alexander. I'm sure that made for a little bit of confusion in the Jewish preschools. The second thing they said was that we will collect taxes for you, and we will take care of that situation. That very soon led to very terrible corruption. It was so bad that the Talmud said anybody who was a tax collector was presumed to be a thief. We also know that the same thing happened under Roman rule. But that was a much earlier history than just Roman rule. That also happened under the Greeks. Now, this also caused a problem that we're going to see later in this book, in the book of Daniel. And that is, they were really inviting Greek culture into Jerusalem, weren't they? Naming their children Greek names, taking Greek taxes. And in fact, what we see here is we start seeing the inroad of Greek culture into Judaism, and that is going to create a tremendous problem. Later in this book, we're going to see it in this chapter, the huge problem that caused, because many of the Jews readily adopted the Greek culture and discarded Judaism as a result. So a big problem. Well, why did Alexander spare Jerusalem? There are conflicting stories on that. Talmud tells us something. Josephus tells us something else. One story we get is that Alexander says he had a vision. He had a vision. Another story we get from history is that, and this is the one I think I like, is that the high priest came out of the city and showed Alexander the Great Daniel chapter 8. Of course, it wasn't divided up into chapters back then, but he showed them the scroll of Daniel chapter 8 and showed Alexander the Great where their writing said he would win. He would defeat the Persians. And Alexander the Great was so grateful to see that he spared the city. That's what Josephus tells us. I think that's what happened. We don't know that from the Bible, of course, but I think that makes perfect sense with what we know. Why else did he spare Jerusalem? We know he was upset with Jerusalem because they had sided with the Persians. Why did he spare them? I think that's what happened. Daniel chapter 8, verse 8. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Well, this goat waxes very great, magnifies himself. What does that mean? Well, it could denote Alexander and the Greeks' invasions into Afghanistan and into India. I mean, they just went everywhere. They tried to go into every place, even India. And that occurred in 327 BC, so it may be he was magnifying his empire by going places that had not been conquered. I think it more likely it refers to Alexander's pretensions of divinity, which is a theme in the book of Daniel. Men who think they're God. We saw it with Nebuchadnezzar. You know, we saw it. We're seeing it, I think, perhaps here with Alexander. We've seen it already with Domitian and the Roman emperors. So I think that's very likely what we see here. We're going to see it later today with another famous historical character that's also on your handout, Antiochus Epiphanes. So I think it's likely this magnification here in verse 8 is Alexander's own belief that he was divine. I've mentioned he went down to Egypt. Well, he came up from Egypt. He probably already had a pretty big head, having conquered the known world. But he came up with Egypt with even a bigger head because they convinced him he had descended from Zeus. And he took that very seriously. And he then required all his comrades to prostrate themselves in front of him. So I think that's probably what's being talked about in verse 8. Now, this horn is broken at the height of its power. And in its place, we have four others. We've talked about the number four, and it can be used figuratively to denote earth, worldly things. And certainly that would be a perfect figurative meaning here, that these are earthly kingdoms. But there's also a literal meaning. Because, in fact, after Alexander died, his kingdom was literally split up into four kingdoms. Alexander died in the city of Babylon, by the way, in 323 BC, in his early 30s, probably around age 33. It was a sudden fever brought on by dissipation, is what we're told. The rumor is he was poisoned by someone who wanted to take over his throne. Anyway, after his death, there were attempts to hold his empire together, but it was not successful. By 311, four of his generals had claimed independence, and by 301, they had it. And there were four kingdoms that came from Alexander's kingdom. At one point, there were 13 men trying to carve out kingdoms. At the end of that, there were four standing: Ptolemy, Egypt, Seleucids and Babylonia, and then two others, Lysimachus and Cassander. By the way, Cassander's the most likely suspect for having murdered him if, in fact, he was poisoned. History tells us that this division of Alexander's kingdom was fourfold. Four kingdoms, separate kingdoms. And Daniel had told us that as well hundreds of years before it happened. We're reading it right here in these verses. Amazing predictive prophecies in the book of Daniel. Verse 9. And out of one of them, that would be one of those four horns, came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. And it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Wow. Well, there we have another little horn. We saw a little horn in Daniel chapter 7, and we talked about how that little horn seemed to fit the Roman Emperor Domitian very, very well. Should we expect this little horn to be the same person? No. No. Because this little horn is coming from the third kingdom, Greece. The horn, little horn in chapter 7 came from the fourth kingdom, Rome. This is a perfect example of our interpretive rule that similarity of language does not mean identity of subject. We're seeing a lot of similar terminology here. The little horn and magnifying himself and casting things to the ground that we saw before, but we're in a totally different time frame. Chapter 7 was looking at Rome. Chapter 8 is looking at Greece. So we know we're not going to get the same answer to the little horn here that we got in chapter 7. Okay, well, who is this little horn that comes out of the Greek Empire? Well, we're given clues. So let's look at the clues. One, he grows great toward the south, the east, and the pleasant land, or the glorious land. That's Palestine. That's verse 9. Verse 10, he was able to cast down some of the host of the stars and the host of heaven. Verse 11, the third clue, he greatly magnifies himself. Fourth clue, he took away the burnt offerings. Also verse 11. Fifth clue, he overthrew the sanctuary, verse 11. Number six, he was a king of bold countenance. That's down in verse 23, which we haven't read yet. Number seven, he understood riddles. The King James said dark sentences. That's verse 23 also. He had great power. We'll get to that in verse 24. That's the eighth clue. He caused great destruction. That's the ninth clue, verse 24. And then the tenth one, we've already mentioned, verses 8 and 9, he came from one of the four pieces of the Greek kingdom after Alexander's death. So we have 10 clues as to who this little horn is. After looking at all those clues, there's only one person that this little horn could be, and that's Antiochus IV Epiphanes. So let's talk about him. He was of the Seleucid Empire. That was one of the four pieces of the Greek kingdom after Alexander's death. There's a bust of him here on the handout. It's at the top row. This was always also at the bottom of the handout for lesson 24, if you still have that one. There's a bust of Antiochus here, and there's a coin of Antiochus also. On the reverse of that coin, if you look over toward the left side of the coin, you'll see some Greek writing that's on its side. You'll see a little four-letter word and then a longer word that looks like it starts with an E. That is Theos Epiphanes. Theos Epiphanes, God manifest, on the back of Antiochus's coin. Theos Epiphanes, that's how he got his name, Antiochus Epiphanes. His people had a different name for him. They called him Antiochus Epimenes, which means the mad one. Yeah. So, again, we have someone that's like Domitian. I mean, he's got a lot of similarities with Domitian, but it's not Domitian. For one thing, he's in a different empire, and he's hundreds of years earlier. So, different person, different time frame. Well, why does this person have to be the little horn? Well, let's look at the history of Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. As we've mentioned, after the death of Alexander, the kingdom was split up. Ptolemy and his successors took Egypt. And they were there for quite a while. Remember, you know, Cleopatra, all that? That's Ptolemy's. And at first, the Ptolemies controlled Palestine as well. They also had Palestine. The Seleucids, on the other hand, took over Mesopotamia and Syria. We're about to see a conflict between Syria and Palestine. Right? Headlines? I mean, this has been going on for thousands of years, right? I mean, there's nothing new here. We're seeing the same thing. There was constant friction between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Where do you think that friction was? Palestine. That's where they rubbed together. That's where they wanted. They fought over Palestine. The same thing we're seeing today, and nothing has changed. So, I mean, I just have to pause for just a moment. The hubris of some American president, whether it's the current one or a past one, who thinks he alone is going to go in and solve these problems. I mean, it shows not only hubris, but it shows a total and complete lack of historical knowledge as to what's going on in that part of the world. Okay, I'll get back off that soapbox. In 200 BC, the Seleucids won Palestine. They got it from the Ptolemies in the Battle of Peneus. And again, let me just pause again for something else here. What we're seeing here is still the warfare among the Greeks, right? All they do is fight each other. Can you imagine what the spread of the gospel would have been like if that had still been going on in the first century? You remember, I mean, Paul would just go all over. He would just travel. He was a Roman citizen. He could travel wherever he wanted to go and spread the gospel. Can you imagine the situation if throughout that whole region it had been Greeks fighting Greeks and battles and wars and constant friction? It would have hindered the gospel so much. But that was not part of God's plan. God's plan was to bring in the Greeks, bring in the language, bring in the culture, and then bring in the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. Let me read you just briefly what the Wikipedia has to say about the Roman peace. And I want you to listen very carefully for one particular word. When we get there, I'll note it. Pax Romana, Latin for Roman peace, was the long period of relative peace and minimal expansion by military force experienced by the Roman Empire in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD. Since it was established by Augustus, that's our first of the 11 emperors, it is sometimes called the Pax Augusta. It spanned about 200 years, 27 BC to 180 AD. Now listen to this final sentence from the secular history. The Pax Romana is said to be a miracle, and they put that in quotes, because prior to it there had never been peace for that many centuries in a given area of human history. Let me read that again. The Pax Romana is said to be a quote-unquote miracle, because prior to it there had never been peace for that many centuries in a given area of human history. We can take the quotes around the word miracle, can't we? That was a miracle. That was God doing that. That was the hand of God creating that peace for his kingdom and his son to come into this world. That was God doing that, and he had told us about it way back in the book of Daniel. Now, initially, the Seleucid rule was very popular with the Jews. Remember, the Ptolemies had been in control. Seleucids win, so now they're in control. And initially, the Jews are real happy with this. Why? Because the Seleucids didn't charge as much taxes as Ptolemy did. And in fact, Antiochus III, not the great, but the earlier Antiochus, this father, eased the tax burden initially. So initially, the Jews are happy with the takeover here. But very soon, Antiochus III comes in conflict with Rome. You're already seeing the friction between the Greeks and the Romans. And he gets defeated a few times, and suddenly he has to pay a large annual indemnity to Rome, and suddenly he needs money, so what does he do? He starts taxing the Jews very heavily. Now, he's killed. Antiochus III is killed in 187 BC while he's raiding a temple, trying to get money to pay off the Romans. He's succeeded by Seleucus IV, his son, who continues trying to raid temples and steal money, and he's assassinated in 175 BC. Again, history hadn't changed very much, has it? All happening in Palestine. Well, his brother is Antiochus IV Epiphanes, and he comes to power after the death of his brother Seleucus IV. And Antiochus IV needs to unify his empire He's got threats from Rome, threats from Parthia, threats from Egypt. He needs to unify things. How does he do that? His answer to that question is central to Jewish history from that point to this point. Because his answer to that question, how do I unify all these fighting people, was Hellenism, Greek culture, Greek ideology. He brought that in. He required that. He mandated that. And that activity, his answer to that question, is so central not only to Jewish history, but to what we're being what's being described here in the book of Daniel. Now, Antiochus is particularly identified with Zeus, and that's why he took this name Epiphanes, the God appearing. He thought he was Zeus appearing, the God appearing. He considered himself to be the divine personification of Zeus. Now, he was virtually penniless when he took the throne. So, you know, what to do? What to do? Well, he raised the taxes, and he continued to rob the temples. Now, the Jews were very unified in their opposition against the taxes. But the Jews were divided in how they thought, what they thought about Hellenism. They were divided. The younger Jews were very eager to accept Greek culture and discard their Jewish identity. The older Jews, of course, were tended to be the traditionalists, and they did not want the change. But many of the younger Jews were willing to accept the Greek culture. Now, matters kind of came to a head in Jerusalem when two men tried to out-bribe each other to be named high priest. That's how you became high priest at this time. You would bribe Antiochus, and the winner of that contest became high priest after paying off Antiochus, and he then built a Greek gymnasium within sight of the temple. And there, the young men, including the priests, we are told, would study Greek culture and take part in sports at the Greek gymnasium. Now, the intertestamental books, they're not part of our inspired text, but they appeared in the Jewish literature in between the Testaments. And one is called First Maccabees. And here's how it describes what happened. Whereupon they built a place of exercise at Jerusalem according to the custom of the heathen, and made themselves uncircumcised, and forsook the holy covenant, and joined themselves to the heathen. Well, Greek sports were conducted without clothing, and this was all happening within sight of the temple. And also, when First Maccabees said that they made themselves uncircumcised, it is not just speaking figuratively. Apparently, we're told that some of the Jews actually tried to reverse their circumcision with surgery. Now, later, the high priest, this is the same one who had obtained his position by bribing Antiochus, assisted Antiochus in plundering the temple itself. And he said nothing while Antiochus murdered the Jewish citizens and nearly destroyed the city. Now, later, an altar to Zeus was built in the Jewish temple, and sacrifices were offered on that altar to Zeus in the Jewish temple, the Holy of Holies. And this was not at all that happened. Here's what one text tells us. Antiochus issued decrees forbidding the practice of Jewish religion on pain of torture and death. The Sabbath and the festivals were not to be observed. Circumcision was forbidden. On pain of death, if you circumcised your child, that was a death sentence. Copies of the Torah were to be destroyed. Jews were to be forced to offer sacrifices to Zeus and eat the meat of the sacrifices. Pigs were deliberately chosen as the sacrificial animals because they were considered unclean by the Jews. Well, this led to, of course, a lot of problems. One elderly priest named Mattathias refused to sacrifice to Zeus. He stood up, and with his five sons, he rose up and killed the king's officers who were trying to make them make those sacrifices. And that event led to the Maccabean Revolt, which you know from history. And the Maccabean Revolt eventually led to the first independent Jewish nation in that part of the world since before the Babylonian captivity. And in fact, that nation, though, only lasted about 79 years because the Romans marched in 63 BC under Pompey, and then Jerusalem was under Roman control. But the Maccabean Revolt came about from all that Antiochus Epiphanes did to the Jews. Let's go back and look at our clues. Why are we saying that this little horn was Antiochus Epiphanes? Well, the first clue is that he grew great toward the south, the east, and the glorious land, Palestine. Well, that's what the Seleucids did. That's where they grew great. That's the directions they were in. And he was a Seleucid. Two, he was able to cast down some of the host of the stars and the host of heaven. Well, the stars of heaven, the host of heaven, those are referring to the people of God. Those are referring to the saints who at this time were the Jews. The Jews were the people of God at this time. And I think that may even be pointing back to the promise to Abraham in Genesis about the stars and the number of the stars. But I think that's who it's referring to. And Antiochus did cause many of the stars of heaven to fall to the ground because he caused many of the Jews to renounce their covenant with God, turn their back on God, and instead embrace his Greek culture, Antiochus' Greek culture. So that's also true of Antiochus. Third, he greatly magnified himself. Well, he thought he was God. He called himself God manifest. You can see that on the coin on the handout. He thought he was the son of Zeus. So yeah, he magnified himself. Number four, he took away the burnt offerings in verse 11. Yeah, verse 11 tells us that. That whoever this is would do that. And in fact, that is exactly what Antiochus Epiphanes did. He took away the burnt offerings and instead had offerings to Zeus. Pigs offered in the temple to Zeus. The prince of the host there in verse 11, that may be Jesus. Many commentaries think it is. And he magnified himself up to that height that he thought he was the Son of God. He took on the divine mantle himself. We also saw something similar in chapter 7 with Domitian. He overthrew the sanctuary, verse 11. Well, he looted the temple. He put an altar to Zeus in the sanctuary. Six, he was a king of bold countenance. Even the Roman Pompey would not disrupt the Jewish worship. But Antiochus did. Yes, he was a king of bold countenance. He understood riddles or dark sentences. Another translation might be he was skilled at double dealings, which is certainly true of Antiochus. He was very crafty and very devious. Number 8 and 9 on the list of clues, he had great power. He caused great destruction. Well, we just saw that. We just saw in the history all the destruction he caused in Jerusalem. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes is the little horn here in chapter 8. And in fact, nearly all commentaries are in agreement on that. He persecuted the people of God ruthlessly. He overthrew the sanctuary. He caused the daily sacrifices to end. He caused many of God's people to fall by causing them to renounce God in favor of the Greek gods and Greek culture. Why was he so successful in doing that? I think verse 12 gives us the reason behind his success. It was through transgression. It wasn't that God lacked power. It was that the people were evil. They allowed him to do these things. In fact, many of them embraced the Greek culture. And they allowed him to do many of the things he did. Think about the high priest bribing each other to become high priest. That's transgression. And that allowed him to do many of the things that he did. Verse 12 says he would cast the truth down to the ground. Well, that's what he did. He forbid scriptural faith and scriptural services on pain of death, and he cast that all to the ground. The Maccabean Revolt is a fascinating part of history. We'll be talking a little bit more about it in Daniel, but if you want to read a very fascinating part of history, that's it. The Maccabean Revolt to Antiochus Epiphanes. Verse 13, "Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden under foot? And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 days, 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." Okay, we've come to a tough verse, so we're going to take our time. We're not going to finish this verse today, but let's talk about it. Daniel hears a holy one or a saint, probably an angel, ask how long the sanctuary and the people would be trampled underfoot. How long is this going to last? A second holy one provides the answer, and the answer is 2,300 days. Literally in the Hebrew, it's 2,300 evenings and mornings. 2,300 evenings and mornings. Let's first talk about that question, how long? We saw that question last week when we flipped over to Revelation 6, verse 10, and talked about how that is really the theme of the book of Revelation. How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? As we mentioned earlier, that verse is really the theme of Revelation. Here we have the same question. How long? How long is this going to go on? But the answer we get in verse 14 is just a little curious. 2,300 days. We're going to see the same question again in Daniel 12, verse 6, by the way, how long? But let's look at the question here in Daniel chapter 8. The 2300 days of verse 14 presents one of the most difficult interpretive issues in the book of Daniel. And not surprisingly, the commentaries are all over the map about what this one means. All over the map about what this one means. I'm going to be talking about what I think it means, but let me end today's class by talking about something that it does not mean. The Millerites, may have heard of them. They were followers of William Miller, who in 1833 decided that Jesus would return in 1843. William Miller, Millerites. He's going to come back in 1843. How did he get 1843? Is that? Well, Miller started with 457 BC, which is about the year that Ezra led the second return from exile. Later, when we get to the 70 weeks, we're going to be talking about the returns from exile. We're going to see there's not just one, there's three, at least three of them. This is the second one. It happened in 457 BC. If you start in 457 BC and you count forward 2300 years based on verse 14 and the so-called year-day method of prophetical interpretation, we'll talk more about that also if there is such a method, you come up with 1843. That's how he came up with 1843. Taking the second return from exile, adding 2,300 years from the 2,300 days in verse 14. Well, as we know, Christ did not return in 1843. And what happened after his failure to return became known as the Great Disappointment. Capital G, capital D, the Great Disappointment. You know, I'm not sure if they were disappointed in Jesus or disappointed in Miller, but they were disappointed that Jesus did not come back when Miller said he would. Out of the Great Disappointment, there arose various sects, and one of them was the Seventh-day Adventists. The Seventh-day Adventists came out of the Great Disappointment. The Great Disappointment came out of Miller's false view of verse 14 in the 2300 days. What came out of the Seventh-day Adventists? The Branch Davidians of Waco. Remember early 90s? Fire? I remember it very well, because one of the very first ATF agents killed that day was a graduate of mine at Katy High School. Graduated from Katy High School, was in my class. I remember it very well. And yes, you can draw a straight line from a false view of the 2300 days to the Branch Davidians in Waco. That's a straight line. So does it matter what we believe and teach about the book of Daniel? Yes, it does. It does. And does it matter when false prophets come out and claim to know when Jesus is going to return again? Even when we know that Jesus himself does not know that day? Yes, it does matter when they do that. Because they create great disappointments when they do so. And we see what happens when these man-made great disappointments occur. And that's what happened here and with regard to the Seventh-day Adventists and the Branch Davidians. It all came from false teaching about the book of Daniel. That's where it started. Yes, it does matter what we believe about the book of Daniel. And that's a very good example for that. Let's talk then briefly about the 2300 today. We'll talk more about it next week. There's at least three choices we have with regard to what the 2300 days means. One, it could be a literal 2300 days. Two, it could be a literal 1150 days. Okay, well, how do I get 1150? Remember, it's 2300 evenings and mornings. Every day has one evening and one morning. So to get the number of days, we may have to divide by two and get 1150 days. By the way, 2300 days is about 6 years, and 1150 days is about 3 years. So we're looking at about six, about 3 years. Those are two possibilities. The third possibility is that it could be symbolic. Now, generally, under our rule of interpretation, we're going to assume symbolic unless we have good reason to do otherwise. Unfortunately, there's no real symbol that's 2300. I mean, we don't really have one or a multiple of it, so it's hard to know which symbol it is. So next week, we're going to start off with this verse, and we're going to look at those three possibilities. Literal 2300, literal 1150, or figurative. And we're going to try to figure out which of those three it is. Next week, we'll start there. Thank you very much for your attention.